Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, July 28, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on protecting eligible voters, Evenwell versus Abbott, and the future of redistricting. My name is Katie McClendon. I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Michael Connolly, counsel at Consovoy McCarthy, and Ilya Shapiro, senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute. Ilya co-authored an article for the Federalist Society Review on this topic, which can be found at our website. Michael, you have some opening remarks, followed by remarks from Ilya, and then we will open the floor to your questions. Thank you for speaking with us, Mike. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Katie. So, my name is Mike Connolly. I'm counsel at Consovoy McCarthy, and we were the attorneys for the plaintiffs in Evenwell versus Abbott. And that was a case that was heard in the Supreme Court last term. And the Supreme Court in Evenwell decided that states can rely on total population figures when they are doing their redistricting. We as plaintiffs had argued that the Constitution, the one person, one vote rule of the Constitution required that states use eligible voters when doing redistricting. So it was a very big case from this term, really fascinating too, went into a lot of interesting constitutional, political, even philosophical issues. So what I thought I'd do is talk a little bit about sort of the background of the case, the doctrine, and a little bit about the opinion, and then I'd turn it over to Ilya to give us a little bit more of his thoughts of what the court did. So, very briefly, the 14th Amendment obviously prohibits states from denying anyone the equal protection of the law. For almost a century after it was enacted, the court said that the 14th Amendment had nothing to do with redistricting, and that states were essentially free to do what they wanted when it came to redistricting. Around the 1950s, 1960s, that started to change, and probably what spurred on the court to act was you were having lots of districts across the country that were malapportioned, meaning that often you'd have one senator in a rural district representing 10,000 people, and then a senator in a city representing 100,000 people. And I think this sort of spurred the court to act, and they said that needed to do something. And so in a series of cases, Baker v. Carr, Reynolds v. Sims, the court laid out a doctrine known as the one person, one vote rule. And essentially what this rule said was that an individual's right to vote is unconstitutionally impaired when its weight is diluted when compared with votes of other citizens in other parts of the state. And the example they often use is that it would be unfair to give one person 10 votes while giving his neighbor one vote. And these were very big cases in the 1950s, 1960s, and they completely transformed redistricting across the country. Now, what was interesting is that the court basically left unsaid what population needed to be equalized. So the theory behind one person, one vote was about vote dilution. So it was about making sure that, like I said, one person's vote was equal to another. But they often, almost always, used just total population figures. And this wasn't a problem until, maybe the last 10 or 20 years, when you started seeing, often in the South, often in heavily immigrant populations, malapportionment in terms of eligible voters. And so what would happen is you'd often have equal number of people, but not equal number of citizens or equal number of eligible voters. So Justice Thomas was one of the justices that frequently called upon the court to address this problem and to bring some clarity to what the one person, one vote rule required. And that is when we stepped in. In 2014, we brought a lawsuit on behalf of Sue Evenwell and another individual out of Texas. And these individuals in Texas came from districts that had a high number of eligible voters relative to other districts. And the theory of our case was that their right to vote was being denied based on under the one person, one vote rule. And we called for Texas to essentially redo their districts along eligible voters. The district court disagreed. They said that this case was not justiciable, that essentially this was an issue that the states could decide however they wanted, whether they wanted to use eligible voters or total population. We appealed to the Supreme Court, and it was actually an appeal because this was coming out of a three-judge panel. And so the Supreme Court found probable jurisdiction, and it was heard in the fall of last year. And, you know, when it was heard, I mean, this is a good example of why you should not maybe place too much stock in what happens in oral argument. When it was heard, most commentators you read thought it was going to be a very close decision. That turned out not to be the case. So the court ruled 8-0 that Texas's districting was constitutional. So writing for the majority, Justice Ginsburg said that using total population as Texas did was fine. She essentially gave three reasons. Her first reason was that the Constitution apportions the House on population basis. So essentially what she said is that it makes no sense that the 14th Amendment would prohibit something that the Constitution prescribes. And then she said that precedent had always done it based on total population, and that she noticed that most states also right now use total population figures. Importantly, what she did say was that they were not addressing whether total population was required. So the court explicitly said it was possible that that a state could use eligible voters to do redistricting, but that they would leave that decision for another day. Justice Thomas concurred. Justice Thomas said that the state could use total population if it wanted, but essentially his reasoning was that the Constitution doesn't really support one person, one vote. He essentially rejected the whole doctrine. And then Justice Alito also concurred. He also found that what the state of Texas did was fine, but what he wrote separately to say to take issue with what the state did or what the majority did as far as relying on constitutional history. He said that the founders' decision to apportion according to total population had nothing to do with one person, one vote. It was about political power. It was about federalism, and he disagreed with the majority's decision to use that. So that was the ultimately the opinion that came out, and like I said, it was 8-0, and so the case is over now. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ilya to get his little more analysis and his take on what the court did.
Sure. Thanks, Mike. This was a fascinating case. So to reiterate or summarize what Mike said, the court held unanimously for Texas. That is, not for the challengers who wanted to use wanted to require the state to use some measure of eligible voters. They proposed citizens of voting age, and not for the U.S. government, which said that you have to use, which argued that you have to use total population when districting, but rather Texas's position is that just defer to the states. States have been doing lots of different things. They're all permitted unless there's some egregious violation of some sort. And indeed, Texas notes in its own brief on the merits that 10 states don't just use total population. They look at total population and then they exclude aliens or non-permanent residents or non-resident military personnel, inmates, students, and other types of people. So you might hear a lot of commentary about this case, how the challengers were arguing for something that's completely unprecedented. Well, it's simply not the case that in all 50 states they just district based on total population, period. There is some variety. In any event, six justices reached the conclusion that a state may apportion districts on the basis of total population, even if it leads to a wide disparity in the number of eligible voters. And Justice Thomas and Alito reached the same result, but for very different reasons. Justice Ginsburg begins her majority opinion, which, my colleague Tom Berry and I argue in the Federal Society Review paper that Katie mentioned at the outset, which you can find on the Federal Society webpage or on my webpage on the Cato site. This majority opinion by Ginsburg relies on a misreading of the Federalist Papers and a misunderstanding of the different interests and incentives at play in federal and state apportionment rules. Now, Ginsburg begins by quoting a passage from Federalist 54, in which James Madison discusses the federal rule of apportioning representatives among the states. Madison explains that, quote, it is a fundamental principle of the proposed Constitution that representatives be allocated based on the state's aggregate number of inhabitants, and at the same time, the state itself may designate who is eligible to vote for those representatives. The majority takes this use of total population to mean that, quote, the framers understood that non-voting citizens were nonetheless entitled to representation in government. But in practice, counting disenfranchised persons for the purpose of apportionment, which Ginsburg calls granting them representation, simply means adding to the number of representatives chosen by the enfranchised people in their states, and so increasing the voting power of the already enfranchised. It begs the question of what to do, how to count or not to count those who are enfranchised. Did the framers really believe that, for example, wealthy landholders would vote with the interests of their disenfranchised, landless neighbors at heart? That is, when voting qualifications had a property ownership element to them. The colonists had, after all, rejected the British argument that they were virtually represented by members of Parliament for whom they had no vote. That's kind of the strongest or the biggest argument for virtual representation, that the MPs in England still spoke for the colonists. And this repudiation of virtual representation was therefore one of the contributing factors of the revolution itself. And so even if there were no further evidence as to the intent behind Madison's fundamental principle of total population for apportionment, the majority's claim would be dubious. But in fact, we don't have to speculate, because the quote that Ginsburg cites leaves out the very next sentence of Federalist 54, in which Madison himself explains that this fundamental principle was chosen not to provide virtual representation, but because, quote, the qualifications on which the right of suffrage depend are different in every state. So states, then at the founding as now, control their own rules of voter eligibility. That gives states political power giving states political power based on their voter populations would have incentivized them to enfranchise as many residents as possible. You know, one state could decide, yeah, we'll let 12-year-olds vote because that gives us more voters, and therefore if you're enfranchising based on total voting population, then we get more representatives in Congress. which distorts the intended federalist system in which each state would be free to choose suffrage rules based solely on what it considers to be best for its population. Indeed, even now, we have plenty of experimentation at the state and local level where non-resident alien green card holders, say, are able to vote, but that doesn't affect any sort of metric or calculation or districting with respect to federal elections. As Madison goes on to explain succinctly, still again in Federalist 54, the total population principle laid down by the convention required that no regard should be had to the policy of particular states towards their own inhabitants regarding suffrage. And that means that the principle was chosen because it neither incentivized nor disincentivized any particular state's choice, which is a consideration that has no analogy at the intrastate level, which is what's at issue in Evanwell. Sub-state jurisdictions, counties, cities, districts, what have you, don't implicate the same federalism concerns, the same dual sovereignty concerns, if you will, as the relationship of states to the federal government. They're supposed to be their own sovereigns and wield power in different ways qualitatively than counties or cities. So where does this decision leave us then going forward? Well, people on both sides can agree that when barely 50% of a legislative district is eligible to vote, that was the extreme case in several of the districts in Texas. I mean, it's really quite remarkable where even though total populations are about the same, the voting populations in the spread between the highest concentration of voters and the lowest means almost double the number of voters in one of the districts than of the other. So that seems to indicate that the democratic system is not in an ideal state. And this isn't, I don't blame the Supreme Court of the 1960s that established the one-person, one-vote principle and then didn't clarify this issue. I don't blame them for leaving this mess. It just so happens that as a matter of empirical fact, in the 60s and early 70s, that was sort of the nadir for foreign-born populations in the United States, the lowest that we've ever had, whereas in the succeeding decades, that has the foreign-born population has grown to such an extent where now we're essentially tied or overcoming the level even of the height of the Ellis Island days. And again, this is not to implicate any sort of argument about legal versus illegal immigration or what our immigration system should be. It's just a matter of foreign-born non-citizens and how that affects, again, the number of voters in any particular district. The framers of the 14th Amendment lived in a country, moreover, where nearly all immigrants became voting citizens within 5 years of arrival, and that's why they counted aliens. There's really no such thing as an illegal alien, and there certainly wasn't such a thing as an alien who'd be living in the country for more than 5 years who did not become a citizen. It was a very different time in that respect. And indeed, the one other group that was counted for apportionment in which virtual representation was applied are women and children. This is the time before women's suffrage, of course, and it was understood or expected that the man of the house, be it the husband or the father, would be voting per the interests of these of women and minors. Disenfranchised adult male citizens, however, were not counted for districting because this was part of the penalty clause of the 14th Amendment. It's important to understand. That's a great overlay on top of everything that we talk about with the Federalist Papers and Madison and the original Federalist structures. Recall that in the 14th Amendment, apportionment of House members in Congress was reduced by the total number of to the extent that adult male citizens were disenfranchised in the former Confederacy especially, but also in other areas potentially as well. Today, all of this is different with respect to non-citizens. The wait for citizenship can last decades, and indeed there's not a path in many cases. And so the total population apportionment rule can grant vastly unequal voting power, which transfers political power from large numbers of non-voting adult residents to their voting neighbors who may or may not share the same political interests. Indeed, even within the Latino community, say, those who are longtime citizens might have very different views on whether it be education policy or police policy or immigration than people who have come very recently, again, legally or not. Because the court declined to solve this problem itself, that's now thrown back to the political branches. Any shift that may affect the balance of political power will be controversial, of course, but states can always experiment with creative forms of compromise. For example, states are free to grant the franchise to some non-citizens, and a simultaneous move to voter-based apportionment alongside a grant of the franchise to legal non-citizen residents who have been in the country, say, for 10 years, could be an attractive solution. Again, federalism is meant to promote different states trying in different ways to resolve these thorny representational issues and how to deal with the how best to represent the interests of the polity and how to define the polity. Again, I'm not endorsing any one solution. The best result will depend on the particular situation and the partisan makeup of the different states. And here, I guess I should add, I'm sort of concluding, but I could have said at the very beginning that this case should not be seen as kind of the Republican challenge to Democratic power or majority-minority districts or anything like this. We would see different results had Evanwell prevailed in Texas versus, say, a state like Utah. In Utah, if districting were done based on eligible voters, that would move power from the rural, more Republican districts to the more urban, say, Salt Lake City, more liberal, more Democratic districts, because the outlying areas, the suburbs and exurbs, have more children, non-voters, who are nevertheless counted as part of total population, than the urban districts. So again, this is not simply a case of being a challenge by white conservatives versus Latinos or Latino Democrats or anything like that. Your mileage may vary depending on the state and the particular circumstance. Going forward, the most important thing is that, at least if we take this opinion at face value, is that courts are not supposed to interfere with the process and declare that states may only draw their districts on the basis of total population. So in the future, we may see, after the 2020 census, say, some states may experiment and indeed move to some sort of eligible voter or citizen of voting age metric. There undoubtedly would be a challenge to that, and then that future court would have to deal with the question on which it punted, which is whether states can use voter eligibility for districting, not simply whether they have discretion to use total population. So in conclusion, the Supreme Court, I think, erred in reading the virtual representation theory as playing a part in our democratic constitutional tradition, outside of a few discrete areas where other interests are implicated at the federal level. But it would err grievously to read it as playing, to read the virtual representation theory as playing the only part in our constitutional tradition.
Thank you both so much for your comments. I'll now open the floor to questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then pound on your telephone keypad. While we're waiting for people to get their questions together, I'll just ask you both what you think the immediate and or long-term impact of the Evanwell decision is going to be. Do you have any forecasts?
So this is Mike. The court explicitly left open the possibility that states can use eligible voters to do their redistricting decisions, and I didn't see anything in the opinion that would foreclose them, you know, in the future from saying that that was okay. The gist of the opinion I got was that this is close enough and we're not going to mess with what the state is doing. So if in the future a state wants to try this, you know, it's possible the Supreme Court could find that total population is mandated, but the option is definitely open for now. And, you know, I think it is possible that a state could want to do that. So, like Ilya was saying, Texas was very malapportioned as far as eligible voters go. You had certain districts that were 55% deviations, meaning that, you know, almost someone's vote was worth almost twice as much depending on where he or she lived. And what we had argued in our complaint at the Supreme Court was that the state didn't even try to equalize eligible voters. They didn't even look at it. And that's what we were asking the court to do, is send it back and ask them to look at it. So, you know, it's still open that that a state could want to try to do both, you know, try to balance eligible voters and try to balance total population. So I think the option is available. Whether a state will take up the invitation is, you know, anyone's guess.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke a bit to this at the end of my initial remarks. There's an interesting and I think telling discussion during oral argument where I forget which justice was asking Scott Keller, the Solicitor General of Texas, whether it's even possible to take into account both total population and some sort of voter population metric. And Scott was saying, well, yes, both could be considered in theory. And there was the battles of demographers and other social scientists, indeed, about not just whether we can get accurate measures of eligible voters or citizens of voting age, but whether you can combine these two interests or these two criteria while at the same time satisfying demands of the Voting Rights Act, for example, so as not to dilute the so-called ability to elect candidates of their choice of members of racial and ethnic minorities. So that's certainly an open question. If and when a state tries to incorporate a voter equality metric, it will be very interesting to see, and probably outcome determinative as a matter of law, whether at the same time they pay or how much heed they pay to equalizing total population at the same time.
Let's go to our first question. A reminder, once you hear the prompt, you may ask your question.
Yes, good afternoon. Joe Lebezowski from Point Plus Partners. Kind of twofold. Obviously, redistricting is very prevalent in today's election races. I've worked in politics for a number of years in Illinois and other races, also in Texas. But, you know, with the redistricting, we've seen a number of candidates actually lose elections because of redistricting. And even in Chicago, where you actually have dead voters, believe it or not, on the polls, we were at an inaugural event with Chris Christie, a 2012 race against Mitt Romney, and I kind of joked around with him at Elmhurst College that, hey, you know, how many voters in Chicago are, you know, dead people, maybe my mother's voting, you know. But obviously, is that an issue in some of these close contested races? And then maybe my second question to the Cato Institute is, you know, some senators have also mentioned, you know, where we're on bills, you know, say we're having a CTA bill for transit in Chicago, that's actually tied to agricultural bills in downstate Illinois, which, you know, this congressman had no intention of, you know, obviously passing. So maybe you could talk about both those issues in the broader context. Thank you.
Well, the first question, this is Ilya Shapiro. The first question I think goes to fraud and or kind of technocratic administration of voting lists, so that you have periodic cleaning up or purging of the list of people who have died, moved away, perhaps are no longer eligible for whatever reason. There is some ongoing litigation over the cleaning of voter rolls in Ohio, for example. I believe the lower court ruled that for the most part the governor or the state secretary of state's actions in cleaning up the rolls are satisfy the Constitution and the Voting Rights Act. It's now on appeal to the Sixth Circuit. This is, I'm not sure whether how much fraud goes on in terms of dead people voting. Most fraud these days is neither that nor in person impersonation that's cured by voter ID. It's mostly through absentee ballots, improper registrations that then get a ballot, all mail-in balloting, as of the case that what happens in Washington and Oregon states now. I'm sure there are people who vote for the dead sometimes inadvertently. There are people who aren't really familiar with the system but feel that because my spouse died within 2 weeks of the election and we already had the card from the registrar indicating where to go, well, that just means I get to vote for him or her or something like that. There are some inadvertent fraud, if you will, or improper voting. And then to your second question about the linking of disparate interests within a state or the way that districting works, where particular representatives might have constituents that have very different interests, part urban, part rural. You do see those extremes. I don't think Illinois is by any stretch, the worst for these kind of weird gerrymanders. I think Maryland probably gets the wins on that one, where you have inner city Baltimore connected to some counties that border Pennsylvania that have nothing to do with the same interests. Much of this is driven by politics, and the Supreme Court has been wary of getting involved in gerrymandering that's driven purely by politics, although obviously it's an open and very heated question when partisan considerations are tied in with racial and ethnic ones, or characteristics at least. And part of it is driven by Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which, as I mentioned, is meant to prevent voter dilution in redistricting, which means once you've achieved, say, 55% minority in a particular district, or even if you've achieved, say, 40%, whatever the percentage is, it's very hard on the subsequent redistricting to reduce that percentage. And so as the line drawers try to pack more of these sorts of voters into one district while taking into account other considerations, this is what you get, these weirdly formed districts. I mean, I think it would be great if we could just draw lines based purely on natural geographic and civic boundaries, but we won't get there in terms of Voting Rights Act jurisprudence for quite some time.
This is Mike Conley. One thing I would add in the sort of the impact you see with certain malapportionment is it does actually have effect on public policy. So in the 1950s and 1960s, before the one person, one vote doctrine came out, there were the rural districts did have much more power. So you did tend to see legislation that favored farming interests and lower taxes, that sort of thing. And now it's kind of flipped. Now the power has moved towards the cities in lots of these places. So, more city programs, usually probably higher taxes to fund government programs, that sort of thing, that impact the cities of these states. So it's often, you forget that these malapportionment does have a real-world effect. It's not just sort of a theoretical thing.
I'll remind our listeners that to ask a question, you'll have to enter star and then pound. And while we wait for our next question, let me announce that our next scheduled telephone call will be on Monday, August 1st at 2 p.m. We'll hold a conversation with Andrew Grossman and Peggy Little about the climate change investigations. So keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls, and you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federal Society's website, fedsoc.org. And visit our website to listen to podcasts of previously recorded teleforums that you might have missed. Well, seeing no more questions at the moment, there's one. Let me go to that caller. Did our caller get a prompt to ask their question?
Sorry, I had it on mute. This is Roger Candelaria. Thank you, Mike and Ilya, for an excellent presentation. It used to be customary for the big distinction to be drawn between a republic and a democracy, at least in theory. And in the last 20 or 30 years, that distinction seems to have faded from the public consciousness. My question is that in terms of voter jurisprudence, election jurisprudence, has the pendulum shifted so far that the basic notions of that distinction of a republic are lost for the foreseeable future, or is there still a solid respect for that distinction in jurisprudence?
Sorry, what distinction?
Between a republic and a democracy,
Well, these are political terms of art. It's not like courts are going around engaging in kind of academic discussions of what defines a democracy versus a republican, or what the proper ratio is, or how many checks and balances you need to add to a democratic system to make it a republican one. And indeed, almost every case involving a challenge based on the guarantee clause, that is, that the Constitution guarantees a republican form of government in every state, almost all of those get dismissed as a political question. So that distinction plays a much larger role in political punditry and academic literature than it does in court cases.
Any other callers can press star and pound in the next minute or so to ask another question. But in the absence of any new questions, remarks?
I'm sorry, did you say closing remarks?
Yes.
Not too much more from me. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens going forward, what states decide to do with this opening. I also think it's interesting to see what will happen with in the vote dilution context. We always understood Reynolds v. Sims, Baker v. Carr to be about vote dilution, and that those protected the fundamental, equal right to vote. And if that is maybe not the case, as the Supreme Court might be indicating in Evenwell, it'll be interesting to see whether that has a ripple effect in other lines of cases and other doctrines involving vote dilution.
Well, I'll just say, this is Ilya. I look forward to filing more amicus briefs and more of the cases that Mike and his colleagues at Consulate McCarthy Park file. And if you want to read more on this, there actually hasn't been as much commentary as one would have thought on Evenwell once the opinion came down, because it was unanimous and it was a punt in several respects. In addition to my article in the Federal Society Review, actually at the beginning of the article, Katie was good enough to find, and her team enough to find, links to various commentary that perhaps takes a different perspective from mine. And if you want a kind of a summary of what I've been saying, or a summary of that longer FedSoc review piece, Tommy Berry and I had an op-ed of the National Law Journal in April that you can look up as well. But this was a very different type of districting case. It goes to the heart of what one person, one vote means. And it's not often that you get these sorts of first principle cases where there's little precedent. And it's kind of neat when the justices are directly citing the Federalist Papers for support, even if, as here, they get it wrong. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Mike Connolly and Ilya Shapiro for joining us today. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please join us for our next teleforum Monday at 2 p.m. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.